The childbearing years are, in fact, a really sort of significant period in the lives of most women and men and children, and have clearly, you know, a lot of attention over time. Artists, poets, writers, psychologists, psychiatrists, we spend a lot of time thinking about this because of the significance emotionally, psychologically, and the meaning that this time has in the life of both child and parent. And this is true not only for women, I will say, but also for men. So you see that the pictures, you know, sort of capture both experiences. And it's true not only for humans, but it's also true for non-human primates, that this is an important period of time that sets the stage for later development in many ways. And I'll share some research that sort of describes how that might be true and what that might look like. Truly, this time is important for both parent and for child. And one thing that we know, I'm a developmental and clinical psychologist by training, and a lot of the work that I do developmentally is based in what we refer to as attachment theory. And in this field of work, we have over 5 decades of research that really tell us that when babies come into the world, they are born hardwired to form a very important, significant, enduring bond to their primary caregivers. And this early relationship actually forms a foundation for later emotional development, cognitive development. It's very significant and very important, and it is universally true. And it's also true that the biology that we all have as adults in this species also leads us to sort of be hardwired to provide care, to provide nurturance and care to our young kids. It's our innate sense of how to be close to and care for a baby. So, you know, I sort of would ask you to consider, you know, what happens when a tiny little baby smiles, for example, and people in the room feel drawn to provide care. Or the tone of voice that parents use when they talk to their babies. You know, they often will use what we refer to as parentese, the higher pitch, oh, hi, baby. I can't do it, my cold. I'd be a very poor parentese illustrator, but I'm sure you can imagine this. So there are many things that are sort of hardwired and built in and generally go well for most parents and kids. But it's also true that this is a very difficult and challenging period in life, and that's universally true. So ignoring sort of what's on the slide for a moment, where I'm talking about depression and anxiety, which might be sort of on one end of the extreme, universally, the birth of a child, the arrival of a neonate who is totally and utterly dependent on you for care, is a very overwhelming experience in the life of a caregiver provider. I don't know how many of you have had that experience, but certainly I can attest to it from personal experience that it's a very profound, wonderful, but also overwhelming moment to realize that you're responsible for this other person. Complicating that, many, many women, and in fact many men, experience depression and anxiety during the child bearing period. And this can further complicate the task of engaging in the parenting task and give rise to lots of feelings that I think can be really complicated for parents to navigate. I want to sort of set the stage about what we know about depression, anxiety, and the childbearing year, but then also talk about implications for caregiving and for kids. And I'm going to sort of, you know, I'm going to get to the punchline first to tell you there are challenges, but one of the things that we also know is there's a lot of reason to be hopeful and positive about what can be done to mitigate risks, to treat depression, to treat anxiety, and to improve outcomes for parents and kids alike, because both really want to be able to enjoy and to experience this period of time in a way that is open and to the positive and joyful aspects of the experience. So what are some things that we know about depression? First of all, what this slide is actually illustrating is that, in fact, depression and anxiety are very, very common. the lifetime risk for women for depression is actually 15 to 20%. So 1 in 5 women are going to experience a major depressive episode in their lives. It's about double that that is experienced by men. So for men, it's 7 to 12%. Women are twice as likely to experience depression. And it's not, I'll uncover this, but you'll notice that there are sort of particular ages where this begins to peak. And it is important to note that there are some sort of timing features associated with depression. The onset of depression among women in particular is most likely to occur during periods of developmental or hormonal transition and periods of stress or loss. So what could those be? Onset of puberty in adolescent, premenstrual periods, peripartum, and perimenopause. Those are real peaks in timing for depression and reflect also timing of hormonal changes and fluctuations. There are certain risks that we know are associated with a greater likelihood of depression, and these include genetics or history of prior depression or psychiatric illness. So for onset of perinatal depression. And how many of you know what I talk about? When I say perinatal, I'm referring to pregnancy and postpartum, so across this childbearing period. So if a woman has a history of prior depression, she has a 30% likelihood of experiencing a perinatal depression. She's at greater risk. If she has had a previous pregnancy where she was depressed, then she has a 60% chance of being depressed in a subsequent pregnancy. That's a pretty big number, right? And this would suggest to any of us who have the opportunity to support or be a part of a support system for women who have experienced prior depressions and pregnancies that we want to be alert to the possibility that this may recur and be prepared to provide the support and help that they might need. Psychosocial factors can also contribute. So a number of psychosocial factors that have emerged across the literature as being big predictors of onset of depression and anxiety in the perinatal period include, first of all, the presence or the absence of partner support and social support. So how much support is the woman getting during this time? The degree of life stress, and you can imagine things that might contribute to life stress would include things like poverty. So we know for women in poverty or who are experiencing joblessness that there are much higher rates of depression. Childcare stress. This is probably not a big surprise to anyone. If you are juggling care for numbers of kids at home, that's contributing to risk. And then this isn't all unidirectional. There are things that our children contribute as well. So having a child who has a more difficult temperament can increase the likelihood that you experience postpartum depression. I highlight and sort of keep separate the societal expectations. And one of the things that I really like to underscore when I'm thinking about this is what I refer to often as the myths of motherhood. When we think about this period of time, I sort of started with it can be a time of great joy, it can be a time of great happiness. It turns out that I think that's an aspect of the transition to parenthood that we spend most of our time portraying, talking about, and acknowledging. And we spend far less time talking about the real realities of sleeplessness. If you're breastfeeding, of the pain that you might experience when you're sort of beginning that process of nursing, the stress of work-life balance, these things are really challenging, to say the least, and quite frankly, very overwhelming at periods of time for most parents. And that's not something that we talk about as much. It's not as represented in the literature. And so you see these happy, happy people. Look, there's a mom, and her baby's even helping her with the computer. Isn't that great? So, you know, this is sort of the representation of parenthood, but the reality is actually far, far more complex. I personally also find it, you know, interesting that there are real cultural variations in willingness to acknowledge the challenges associated with the transition to parenthood. And I'll share with you anecdotally from my own experience that I had the experience of having a child, my first child, in a European country. And then my second child was born here. And what I noticed, you know, that was really striking to me was in the country that I was in Europe, people were actually quite willing to talk about the things that were difficult and hard about being pregnant, pardon me, and about, you know, being a parent in the early years. In the United States, my experience was much more that people focused on, you know, things being happy and easy and great, right? It was like, oh, this is great. How are you doing? She's so, you know, fabulous. Women did not talk as openly about, actually, it's hard. This isn't an easy time. So anecdotally, I see that variation. But also from the literature, we know that there's tremendous variation in terms of how different cultures manage, talk about, and acknowledge emotions and also experiences of pregnancy and postpartum. Work-family stress is also a big thing. And here is another place where the Europe-American distinction comes to play. In that most women, if they are lucky enough to have a maternity leave offered to them, have a very brief maternity leave. If we lived in Canada, all of you would have a year off after the baby was born. So whatever your thoughts are about politics, the fact of the matter is many, many women face very early on a real stress about how do I manage raising this child and working and employment. And that's really a dilemma that a lot of families are juggling. All right. When I talk about depression, one of the things that I want to underscore is that we're really thinking about a whole spectrum of issues. Oftentimes, you know, people will talk about, oh, you know, it's really normative to have the blues. And in fact, that's true. If we sort of look at the data, what we see is that most women will experience a period of the blues following the birth of the child. This typically occurs within the first 2 weeks postpartum and is a period of intense hormonal fluctuation. Some of my co-panelists, we have an OB-GYN who I'm sure could talk to us a little bit about the dramatic changes in estrogen levels, for example, that occur from pregnancy to postpartum. But it's a very intense sort of emotional period and a physiologically intense time. This is a normative response. However, the blues don't last for 2 months. And so one of the things that I think often happens is that depression goes undetected because people think, well, it's pretty normal to have the blues, right? One of the things I hope you'll leave with is an awareness that when someone tells you that they've been experiencing the blues, but these blues haven't mitigated over weeks, that it likely is no longer the blues and has actually emerged as a depression. National and cross-national estimates suggest that approximately 15% of women, 14-15% of women, will experience a postpartum depression. And depression in pregnancy is also common. So it used to be thought that when you're pregnant, it was somehow protective. This is no longer sort of thought to be true. Women get depressed in pregnancy. Women get depressed postpartum. One thing that depression, in postpartum depression, is not, and this is, I think, really important, is it's not the same as postpartum psychosis. I'm actually going to say this point again later because I think there is a tremendous amount of stigma around the experience of depression, and part of that stigma arises from what we hear about in the newspaper and in the literature. We don't read on the front page of the newspaper that, you know, 1 in 5, 1 in 6 women are experiencing postpartum depression. And that doesn't sort of get the big headlines that for example, a case of infant mortality, a mother who may have killed her children in a period of psychotic episode gets. So that sort of hits the front pages. We read about it. And what does it say? Does it say postpartum psychosis? No, it says she suffered from postpartum depression. Right. And then a woman has these, you know, feelings, experiences, begins, you know, to be aware of her own depression. And what does she think? Oh, my gosh, if I'm depressed, am I going to be like this person who killed her baby? Depression and psychosis are two different things. Psychosis is very rare. It occurs only in 1 to 2 per 1,000 women, so it's very unusual. It is often the case that women who have postpartum psychosis have earlier premorbid risks, and I think maybe our psychiatrist who will be here, Dr. Music, can talk a little bit more about that if people have questions. What might distinguish postpartum depression from psychosis? But I think it's important that we know that those are two different things, because the stigma can really keep people feeling ashamed or worried about acknowledging the depression that they're feeling, which is actually quite frequent and common in the population. And certainly does not mean that women are going to be at risk for hurting their children. Okay. So how many of you, by show of hand, are familiar with what I mean when I say DSM? Anyone in the room? Okay. Everyone, wow. Okay. So the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual tells us about symptoms and suggests that the criteria for depression include things like depressed mood, loss of joy, a change in appetite and sleep, poor energy and concentration, motor slowing or agitation, feelings of worthlessness, helplessness, hopelessness, and excessive guilt, or death wish and suicidal thoughts. Now, these are, you know, important indicators of depression, but I do want to highlight some of the challenges with identifying depression sometimes. How many of you think changes of appetite and sleep are unique to depression in the postpartum period? Right? You can sort of see where that could be an issue. Poor energy and concentration. Turns out those things are pretty much universal in the postpartum period, right? So we've developed new ways of assessing and screening and thinking about postpartum depression or perinatal depression that don't focus as much on those somatic or sort of concentration symptoms and focus more on things that we know are common and prevalent among women during the childbearing years. We know that perinatal depression, for example, has some unique features, including an excessive level of anxiety or concern about the baby's health or their own performance as a mother. Mothers often talk about feeling like they're going crazy or being afraid that they're going crazy. And in fact, many mothers are fearful or preoccupied with intrusive thoughts that harm will either come to the baby or that something terrible will happen. Oftentimes, parents will tell us, or will not acknowledge these kinds of feelings. So I want to say a little bit about that. Intrusive thoughts of harm befalling the baby are actually very common, so common as to be normative. We know from the neuroscience research that when babies are born, the parental brain changes. And we have some indication that this is true not only for mothers, but also for fathers. And certain areas in the brain become more active. Interestingly, one of the areas in the brain that becomes more active is the area of the brain that we refer to as sort of the OCD circuits, right? The circuitry that is associated also with obsessive compulsive behaviors. Thoughts about why that might be? Yeah? Right. So she said to instigate biologically, you know, that sort of drive to be really protective and to be really involved and aware. And absolutely. So it serves this really important function, most likely biologically. But what it does is it makes women very hyper aware often of all of the potential risks or things that could go wrong, right? And so oftentimes, women will have thoughts about, oh, my gosh, what if I dropped the baby right now? What would happen? Or if I hit the baby's head on the wall when I was turning the corner, what could happen? And it can leave people feeling very worried when they have these intrusive thoughts in light of some of the things that I was talking about before, the media attention, for example, that's paid to women who have caused harm to their babies in a for example, in a psychotic episode. Am I going to be like that? Someone might wonder. If I acknowledge that I have these worries or thoughts about something bad happening to my baby, or even that I might do something to my baby, are they going to think I'm crazy? I feel like I'm crazy. I must be a terrible mom, right? Because my biology is really hardwired to protect and care and nurture. So you can really appreciate why oftentimes people don't disclose these thoughts. And I want people to understand and know that oftentimes those thoughts are very normative. And so when people ask or acknowledge that those thoughts might occur, it could be greatly reassuring to someone. Okay. However, it is also true that we know that women who are experiencing depression or anxiety may be more overwhelmed by those thoughts, have a harder time sort of letting them go, may perseverate about them more, sort of be stuck on it, feeling worried, feeling guilty. There was a study that was done to sort of look at how does depression look in the postpartum period. And what they found was that the dimensions that were most common were things like mood swings, a heightened sense of confusion, and anxiety and insecurity. And interestingly, what they didn't find is that postpartum depression looked like depressed mood. So what does that mean? In sort of plain English, that means depressed women don't just look sad all the time, right? They might look really anxious. They might look overwhelmed. They might look, you know, like they're experiencing periods of intense emotion and that changes. And so those things may, in fact, be the indicator of the depression that the woman is experiencing, not just feeling sad. I want to share just a few quotes from women who have experienced postpartum depression to give you a sense of what this feels like for them. One woman said, "I always knew it was crazy, but I needed to do it. I would write to my baby almost as if I knew I was going to die, which is morbid. I would write what I felt about him and how much I loved him. I think that in the back of my mind, I was always afraid. This is hard to say, but I think I was so out of control that I was afraid that I might kill myself." So some of the things that actually, you know, might stand out to you are just that feeling of intense guilt, right, that comes across in her acknowledgement and the real suffering that she is experiencing around the feelings and the intrusion, the intrusive thoughts that she's having. Another woman said, "It's terrible. It's like the worst thing you can imagine. Think of how you would feel if your husband or child had been hit by a car and killed. Well, it would be just as bad as what I felt during an anxiety attack." And here I want to highlight the word anxiety, right? This is not saying I'm just feeling sad. This is talking about anxiety. Interestingly, we actually know that anxiety in pregnancy is a better predictor of postpartum depression than depression in pregnancy. So anxiety is something we really want to pay attention to. Another woman said, "I would go to my baby's room and think, put the blanket over his head. He's nothing. Then I'd start crying hysterically. I felt like the worst person in the world, the worst mother in the world. I felt tremendous guilt and just wanted to hurt myself." And while this is all concerning, I also want us to know that there are things that we can do about this, and there are things that help. So the first thing that we can do to help is to be aware of the likelihood and the possibility of depression and ask the question about how women are doing and not sort of assume all is well and fine and, you know, create the potential for help. So here are two other women. One says, "When I stopped by my nurse midwife's office, all she had to do was ask one or two questions, and the floodgates opened, and then it became obvious to her what was going on." And the second, "My husband didn't understand what was happening. I didn't understand it either. I felt so guilty because when he came home, I just gave him the baby and couldn't do anymore. I just wanted to get away. When he told me he was worried about me, I cried. I felt so bad, but we both realized I needed to talk to my obstetrician." All right. So I've made this point already, but I think two points that, you know, depression is different than just the blues, and it's also different than psychosis. And again, I think we can talk more about some of this if folks are interested. I said earlier that fathers matter too. I'm going to just share a little bit of this emerging literature. This is an area where there's a lot of work and a lot of interest now because we are beginning to appreciate that men's hormones fluctuate and change in response to women's pregnancies, which I think is very fascinating. We also know that in pregnancy, fathers get depressed too. In the context of postpartum depression, recent research tells us that about 1 in 3 fathers also experience depression. So it's another thing that we can be asking. And why? One, because fathers' experience matters, just like mothers' experience does. And two, because we know that fathers' depression is also linked with child outcomes. And because women, when they have a supportive partner, fare much better and recover much sort of more readily from the depression. So we want to think about the whole family system and how we can get in to provide the support that they need. It's not uncommon for dads to feel left out, probably through the entire pregnancy and early childbearing process, but also in regards to, you know, mental health care support and attention for these kinds of issues. Fathers are going through intense transitions into parenthood, parenting the baby. They're also often sleepless and managing work-life stress. So attending to dad's needs is an important part of supporting families and helping kids. As I said, this is a really new direction in research, a lot of interest in fathers at the biological level and behavioral level, and I think this is going to lead to new and interesting interventions. All right. So one of the things that we want to think about are sort of what are some of the consequences of untreated depression in the perinatal period? Why is this important? Well, it's important, first of all, I just want to say, forgetting the slide for a minute, it's important because people are suffering when they're depressed, and that matters. So the woman's experience, the father's experience, that matters. And it's robbing them. We often hear this from women we work with, that they feel robbed of an important time. So we want to help give them that time. It also matters because untreated depression can lead to a number of poor outcomes for kids that range from biological outcomes, like low birth weight, premature delivery, small for gestational age, and also infant behavioral outcomes like more irritability, and later behavioral and developmental outcomes that are poor. So, for example, one study, showed, and this is interesting, what this is really highlighting for you is outcomes for kids in terms of their stress hormones. How many of you have heard of the stress hormone cortisol? Is that familiar? So this is a hormone that is associated with the activation of the stress system, and it's not great for your body to experience high elevations of stress hormone over time. And what this study showed is that when a child had experienced no exposure to maternal depression, their stress hormone was fairly low. If they experienced it only in infancy, they had a slight elevation, but not a really big elevation. And similarly, if the depression, the mom wasn't depressed in infancy, but was depressed at that 4.5-year-old assessment, not much of an elevation. But for parents who were depressed at both periods of time, their kids had more stress hormone, cortisol. So when I look at this, what this says to me is, we need to make sure that those folks who experienced it in infancy don't end up in the category of those who have it over an extended period of time. We need to get in and provide the supportive preventive interventions so that parents and kids can have better outcomes. And this is, in fact, important. We have from the same group a follow-up where they basically then looked at if kids were in that high cortisol exposure, how were they doing in first grade behaviorally? And we see that the kids who had the highest level of cortisol had poor behavioral outcomes in first grade. So when we think about treating depression early, it's really a preventative intervention, both for the parent and the child. Treatment's important. So with that in mind, what can we do to help? This is, I think, a very optimistic and hopeful story, although I've been talking about some of the hard and not so happy parts of transition to parenthood, because we have an abundance of research that tells us that you can intervene to support and help mitigate depression in the childbearing years. So supportive services and interventions can lead to better outcomes for parent and child alike. We know basically that the experiences that you have can even shape and modify the expressions of your genes. So I will say a little bit more about that. First, I'll sort of look at some data from rodent studies. And it turns out that actually, this may be a surprise to some of you, but we actually share more than 90% of our genetic material with rats. So that's perhaps a little disconcerting, but it makes for the opportunity to do really good research that you couldn't do with humans. So there's some opportunities there. There's a group up in Canada who did really a groundbreaking study that people have been very excited about. And what they did is they had rats that had been genetically engineered. They understood what are the genes that make a rat anxious. Okay, and they could breed a group of rats who had high anxiety genes and a group of rats who had low anxiety genes. And what they know is that the high anxiety gene moms engage in less effective parenting behavior. Parenting behavior that is effective in a rat turns out to be licking and grooming. So they don't engage in as sort of high quality licking and grooming. And low-stress rats tend to engage in more sort of effective licking and grooming. And what they could see is that both the genes and the parenting behaviors are passed on from generation to generation. So this is kind of a graphical depiction of it. Pardon the simplicity, but you have your high-stress rats here who are in red, and you have a high-stress rat mommy. And she has her little babes, and they're high stress, and they grow up to be high stress, and correspondingly the low stress breed. And what we know is, again, that high quality parenting behavior on the low stress side and the poor quality on the high stress. So there's our path, and it passes on to the next generation. But what this group decided to do was something I think that was really innovative and smart. They said, well, what would happen if we took a rat who had those high stress genes and we paired them with a low stress mom? And in fact, what you can see here is they did exactly that, and they called it a cross-fostering study. And what they showed was that, in fact, when you took a high stress rat pup and you had it grow up with, when you took a low-stress mom to raise, my picture is sort of confusing me. Let me just say it to you. So if you take a high-stress breed and you pair it with a low-stress mom, what happens is that little pup grows up to be genetically still high stress, right? We don't change the genes. What we change is the expression of the genes. And so we kept their little ears the same. You can see that now it's, you know, still genetically the same as it was. But if it was raised by someone who was engaging in licking and grooming, it grows up to look like, behaviorally, a low stress little pup, a little rat mom. And what do you think that formerly high stress but raised by a low stress mom does when she has her offspring? She licks and grooms in a low stress way. And so what's passed on behaviorally is the low stress. So the behavior and that change of cross fostering has modified the expressions of the genes, not only for that one, but for the subsequent generations. So this is what we refer to as a gene by environment interaction, essentially, and how environment can modify the expression of genes. This is really important because there's really nothing that I tend to think there's nothing that tells me something is beyond hope. It gives me great hope to think that when we can support parents and they can support, sort of get the support from their environment to parent and feel less overwhelmed by their depression, their risk, their kids are going to be more resilient and have better outcomes. Okay. So a little bit about how do we do that. First of all, we have a number of different kinds of interventions that we can use to support parents in the childbearing years. Some might focus more on the parent-child relationship. So, for example, we have intervention programs locally, things that are called, for example, Mom Power. There are flyers out in the back for some of these groups that you can pick up and read about, and we would encourage you to share them with folks and to distribute them. But these programs really focus on bringing parents together, providing them with support for their mood, education about what that experience in the transition is often like, but also self-care skills and coping strategies and support from other families who are there and can share the experience with them, normalizing what it feels like to be a parent facing these challenges. It also is very much focused on that early bonding with your child and supporting parenting in the early years. So one way that we can intervene is to support the parent and child relationship. Another way that we can intervene is to provide psychotherapy to the parent to address the depression and the anxiety that they're experiencing. And we have a number of evidence-based psychotherapies available to us, many of them offered in the community. Certainly both of these are offered in our perinatal clinic in the Department of Psychiatry. And they include cognitive behavioral therapy and interpersonal psychotherapy. And perhaps Dr. Music can say a little more about that in terms of our clinic. And then there's pharmacotherapy, treating with medication in pregnancy. This is a hot topic and one that is often hotly contested. I will only speak to it very briefly. And then, again, if there are questions about this, I hope that our panelists will be able to speak to it. We have three physicians here who talk with parents about this quite often. But I think the main point that I want to sort of underscore right now is that we really think about, first of all, having a provider who is aware of the risks and benefits of current medications as being a really important and critical issue. And you have some folks here who will be presenting who do a lot of work actually educating providers in the community on this very topic. Why? Because there is no one single right or wrong answer about what to do about medication in pregnancy. Unfortunately, there is no easy answer. I showed you data earlier about the risks associated with untreated pregnancy, and these risks are both psychological and biological. And there may be some risks associated with certain medications, but we also know which ones are more safe and which ones are more risky. So a woman has to sort of make that decision with her provider to weigh the risks and benefits to determine what the way is to go. But we do know that there are a number of safe medication options, and Dr. Music may want to speak to that a little bit more. Finally, we know mind-body approaches can be very helpful. So things like sleep hygiene, focusing on getting more light during the day, but less light at night, really helps to enhance sleep, which can also reduce the risk for depression. Light therapy can be very helpful for some women. For moderate depression, actually, we have some evidence that exercise can work as effectively as medications. So walking outdoors at a brisk pace many days a week, which also has the advantage often of exposing you to light if you don't live in Michigan. If you live in Michigan, it might be more complicated. Diet and nutrition, there's some evidence, for example, around certain nutritional supplements. And then support from others and respite. One thing that I really want to underscore is the importance of sleep. And we often in our clinic will talk with mothers about how they are sleeping, and almost uniformly, if they are depressed, they are not sleeping well. So we really take an aggressive stance towards that because sleep is really critical. You really can't recover from a depression if you aren't getting enough sleep for your body to recover. So we have ideas, some of them listed here, about what might help sleep. But if sleep disruption has been occurring for 4 or more days, it's time to do something more aggressive. It's really time for someone else to step in and to give the mother sleep and to consider other options to help support sleep. And And then finally, community support, which is really important. And I'm really so delighted that there are so many of you here to think about this. How many of you are currently students working in a field, potentially, that you might go out and provide support to people at some point? Okay, great. A lot of you. I'm delighted by that, because I want you to be thinking about these things in terms of how you can provide support, how you can open the doors to ask the questions. How do we sort of build a community of providers who understand this and support women well during times of need, such as early postpartum or pregnancy? Certain special challenges may call for special supports, and these can include things like parenting a young child with a special medical or developmental needs, raising a child who is, for example, in the NICU, parents who are single parenting and don't have the supportive structure sort of around them to step in and help, or parenting under situations of financial hardship and economic stress. So when you hear those things, those are a special sort of trigger to think about, not just asking how the baby's doing, but how is the parent doing as well. And in that sort of frame, what I think about really is that at the center of all of this is a baby. Everyone's oriented towards the baby doing well and thriving, growing into a very resilient, adapted child. And around that is a mother who is holding the child and really helping to carry the child literally into their future. And hopefully what we have is an environment where surrounding the mother is a supportive partner, friends, family, others, the social supports that the mother needs to sort of carry herself and her child through this time. And then all of us. How are we creating a community that provides that kind of support that families need in order to thrive? I am just showing you a couple of the resources that we have available to us. Several of us come from the Women and Infants Mental Health Clinic, but also pediatrics, different programs that we offer in each of these settings, and there are flyers in the back, but I'm going to actually stop now, because I would like, without further ado, to turn it over to our panel. Thank you for your attention and time, but now on to your questions. So why don't we stop here? Before we start with the questions, I do want to have each person, and I'll actually let you introduce yourselves and say a little bit about what you do in this area.
I'm Dr. Lisa Hammer. I am a general pediatrician at the University of Michigan, and my practice is at the Briarwood Center for Women, Children, and Young Adults. I also am an international board-certified lactation consultant, which means I see a very high percentage of my practice is women in childbearing years, so women immediately after postpartum, and I help with feeding issues and breastfeeding issues, and so that puts me in a position to work with a lot of moms who may be struggling with postpartum depression, and I feel it's very important as a pediatrician to be screening mothers for depression and helping support them, because I can care for the baby in the office setting, but of course, the mother and the father are the primary caregivers at home. And if I want the baby to thrive, I need to make sure that the mother's also thriving. And I feel as a pediatrician, I have a role in that. And that's why Maria and Kate asked me to come tonight, and I've partnered with them. And we're doing some unique programs and interventions, partnering pediatricians and OBGYN providers and mental health providers to try to do a multidisciplinary approach to help postpartum moms.
Hi, I'm Lulu. I'm an OBGYN by training. I'm also one of the Women's Health Fellows in the Department of OBGYN. I got involved with mental health during residency. I trained in Cleveland, where a lot of my patients had very chaotic and difficult lives. And not surprisingly, a lot of them had depression either during pregnancy or afterwards. And I really saw them struggle, and they were very, for example, very passive about their prenatal care, or there would be nobody in the delivery room with them, but they were, you know, 16. Or afterwards, you know, they would be very negative about their future. And so I felt really motivated to do something to help them. I spend a lot of my time with these ladies here. I work at the Briarwood Center as well with Lisa and her innovative program, and I also work at the Women's Mental Health and Infant Clinic at the Rachel Upjohn Depression Center, where I'm allowed to see patients and have the privilege of talking to them for very long times and trying to help them sort out some of their problems and things that they're dealing with. One thing I'm interested in as an OBGYN is kind of picking up on depression. You know, we know that we, unfortunately, as a field, we're not very good at picking up on depression, even though we like to think we are. Studies have shown that if we just leave it to our clinical judgment, so whether or not we think a woman looks sad, we probably only pick up about 6% of depressed women, whereas if we used other methods like a screening tool, we'll pick up 6 times more, so that's quite significant. So my goal is to recognize when a woman is depressed, whether by an objective screening method or by being more comfortable probing, because I think a lot of times as a profession we don't like to probe. We just want to pat your belly and hope that everything is going well, but not be afraid to probe, and then make sure that my colleagues are also screening for depression. And then the other thing that I feel like we try and do now that I've done more work in this field is to try and be more positive about pregnancy, because I think a lot of times as obstetricians, we're looking out for the scary stuff. We're focused kind of on the negative. And a lot of times women need to know that, you know, yeah, maybe some things aren't perfect, but they're overall, they're strong, they have lots of strengths, and, you know, there's treatment and their prognosis is good.
Good evening. My name is Maria Music, and I'm a perinatal psychiatrist by trade. Perinatal psychiatrist means that it's not a subspecialty that's officially recognized yet, but it's becoming more and more a field. It's really psychiatric treatment and diagnostics and management in pregnancy and postpartum, and also doing some preconception counseling around mental health. I have been interested in this field for many, many years, and now lucky enough to lead a clinic in our ambulatory psychiatry. That's this building that we are located. It's in East Ann Arbor campus, called the Rachel Upjohn Building or Depression Center. And we have a clinic there for women and infants, mental health, and actually it's a bad name. We should call it family clinic, because we also are there for dads, so and grandparents and everybody. It takes a village to support this time and to raise a child and to support mom and dad in this transition. So on one side, I work there where families come to psychiatry to be seen and get help. But what I'm actually even more excited about is really this work that we have been referring to already, and that actually Lisa started, and I want to really feature this here. We need to reach families where they actually really come, and that's in primary care. And that's where they see the obstetricians, that's where they see the pediatricians. And so really an exciting program that Dr. Hammer started is at Briarwood that we refer to, this women, infants, and young and child and adults clinic, is where it's an co-located, integrated program where families are seen by all these professionals together. It's PEDS, OB, behavioral health, so that's psychiatry, psychology, social work, nutrition, lactation consultation, all in one stop. That's what you need. And we need to be there where they are. Right, where the families are, not somewhere outside where they schlep there, you know, in the winter and hardly get to. So with that said, I think that that's an important piece of our depression center outreach now, to build these integrated programs. And Briarwood is really the model that was established and Dr. Hemp started, and hopefully we can recreate in other clinics as well. So my passion is to really find ways to be innovative, to reach families in need, to provide top-notch information, our expertise. We know a lot, We know about safe treatments. We know about safe approaches. We know how to help. The problem is if we don't reach the ones that need it. So that's my big passion in life.
Okay. So we have great questions, you guys. So, and I've tried to put some together that I think co-occur. So a couple of people have had questions about sleep hygiene. So let me just give you sort of a flavor of some of the questions. One might be, do you have suggestions for sleep hygiene when a child needs to be breastfed every 2 hours? Is there baby care support available if both parents are depressed and need to recover sleep short term? And how do you keep your infant or toddler out of your bed to ensure a full night's sleep? That can be hard, keeping kids in their room. So I'll turn that over. Do one of you want to think about that for a minute?
Thank you. Lisa, do you want to get started?
I can get started. This is a huge topic, which we could probably have a whole other forum to talk for many hours. So as a pediatrician and as a lactation consultant, I deal with this issue every day in my practice. Just about every family that comes to see me is struggling with sleep issues. And I wish I could say to you I had an easy answer for them, but I don't. it has to be, it does have to be very individualized. And it depends on the level of stress and potentially the level of depression a family may be experiencing. If we have a mother who is otherwise coping and is not significantly depressed, I can usually counsel her with some strategies such as increasing her naps, maybe getting a family member or a church volunteer or someone who can, you know, provide a couple hours of respite throughout the day to get some naps. And that can usually work. If we have a mother who is dealing with a more significant depression, sleep deprivation can definitely worsen that depression and make it much more difficult for her to reverse the situation. So we will sometimes intervene with more significant alterations in the schedule. And it sometimes, even though I'm a huge supporter of breastfeeding, sometimes it may not be possible for a given mother to breastfeed every 2 hours throughout the night. It just may be too detrimental to her own mental health, and we will need to make plans for her to get longer stretches of sleep, 6 to 8 hours through the night, and have someone arrange to do the nighttime feedings. So, you know, it needs to be tailored to every individual mother's needs.
Do you want to say?
I mean, I think reflecting what Lisa said, a large part of sleep is having help, which I feel like sometimes mothers, at least in my experience, they don't, they either feel guilty about letting other people do the feeding because they feel like they should do it, or the baby, I've heard, for example, well, the baby likes being on my breast the best, so and they don't like the bottle that much, so I feel like I have to do all the feedings. And sometimes I think they have to let go of some of that to be able to get their own mental health respite. And then I can't emphasize enough how many of my postpartum moms feel so much better once their in-laws or their parents arrive to help them and can get them even just a few nights of sleep a week. It really makes a big difference.
So I just have two quick kind of follow-ups. Agree absolutely with what you said. I'm almost very prescriptive. Sleep is almost like a reset button. I have seen that's why one of these rules is like 4 nights of sleep is like a cutoff. It's a clinically derived random cutoff, but it's not totally random because I've seen women go downhill if they don't sleep for 4 nights. And that means really not sleeping. That means she's feeding or she's up, and then even if the baby falls asleep again, she is awake and ruminating and anxious and can't get back to sleep. So it's a difference between a mom who might be breastfeeding and then is awake, has fragmented, interrupted sleep, or a mom who is not sleeping at all. And several nights of not sleeping at all are really detrimental and can cause a dip in a depression that's quickly going very severe. So providing then sleep potentially even with medications, and often with medication, is almost like a reset button. I've seen women recover and really get much more better in their mood 3, 4, 5 nights of sleep. And so we have like these kind of arrangements where we discuss with family members who can step in, do the night feeds during for these 4 days, and the mom needs to take earplugs and go in a different room and take a sleeping pill and really rest. Because as Kate was saying, moms are so hyper-attuned, and if they don't take a sleeping pill, then they are listening, and then they still can't sleep. So you have to stop that with sleeping pills. And on that note, sleeping medication and breastfeeding is not contraindication. We have medications that we can prescribe during breastfeeding as well as during pregnancy where we have pretty good safety records. So that's a possibility. Of course, other strategies for helping with sleep are, you know, the things that we know, you know, daytime activity, not too much activity too late in the evening, no big meals late at night, you know, soothing teas. Once you are in bed and you can't sleep, don't lay in bed and kind of ruminate, get up maybe and do something, get back to bed when you feel tired again. No, you know, iPhone or an iPad and whatever, like bright light at night, because that keeps us awake. So all these kind of sleep hygiene things that are, you can look it up on the internet. But they're also on our Women's Mental Health webpage.
I think another big important piece is to prioritize sleep. Because I think when babies finally do fall asleep, parents want to do the laundry, do the dishes,
yeah,
do everything else, because that's when they have time. But the priority does in these early months when you are trying to feed every 2 hours, the priority has to be sleep when the baby sleeps, and then let other things go.
Yeah. And use your resources, right? Call for help, because I think, great responses. And I'm glad so many of the questions were about sleep, because I think it is such a critical issue. As you can see, everyone had a lot to say about that. I'm going to switch questions, and there were some questions just about sort of risk for depression or how we think about depression. So does depression vary or depend on the age of a mother? So for example, a 19 versus a 35-year-old. And also, what are your thoughts about 1 year after birth being the cutoff for diagnosing postpartum depression? So
if you guys want, I'm happy to tackle that. So, you know, it's actually the nosology postpartum is very kind of vague. And it's really different what the so-called DSM kind of book of wisdom says, the diagnostic manual, because it basically calls postpartum, if the onset of depression is within the first 4 weeks postpartum, then it's called postpartum depression. It's actually very interesting, because often the depression arises, starts maybe incipiently kind of early in the first weeks, but then actually the peak is at 3 months postpartum, or some women, you know, kind of are having some depressed symptoms and still compensate, and then something happens, other stressors come, and then they really get worse by 5 months. In general, in the perinatal field, we call postpartum depression any depression in the first year after the child's birth. But I have to say that in general, the peak time of onset where we realize depressive symptoms is between the 6-week and the 12-week mark. And that's in part good and in part difficult, because at 6 weeks, this is the last OB visit. So if the OB doesn't get it at that time, it's now the OB visits are out. And so then it's the pediatricians that need to pick it up, because otherwise it falls, this depression falls through the crack if the woman doesn't realize it herself or someone in the family. So often it's this time outside of 6 weeks, around 3 months, 4 or 5 months postpartum where depression is lingering, and that's important to still kind of think about it. So that's the one. And regarding the age, so there are, to my knowledge, no studies where per se the age would put someone at risk or not at risk. It's potentially, what is more likely, it's the associated features given a certain age that might put you more at risk than not. So if you are a young teen mom who did not plan this pregnancy totally through, kind of didn't plan it and doesn't have the resources and feels stressed with other developmental tasks that are ahead of her, that might be more stressful and difficult than if you are a woman who is later in age and things are maybe more settled. But vice versa, if you are older mom and you have no resources and just going through a breakup, you might be more at risk than a younger mom who has the family behind her and has all the resources. So it's more the psychosocial stresses that are connotated with age than the age per se. That's what I would say. What do you guys think?
I would agree with that. I mean, I think, for example, social support has been strongly linked to depression. Having more complications during pregnancy has been linked to depression, which is something we sometimes see in the older moms and the younger moms. Actually, pregnancy at both age spectrums, both ends of the age spectrum, are higher risk, whether you're younger or older than the general population who's having babies. And I think that certainly can contribute to the onset of depression. In terms of, in terms of when depression is diagnosed postpartum in particular, I think one thing, like Maria points out, is the past 6 weeks, for the most part, people have had their six-week OBGYN visit, and a lot of times they don't see at least their own provider, the moms don't, for another year for their annual. And I wonder if it might be helpful for women who especially, no one really likes to call into the obstetrician's office and say that I'm depressed, but maybe consider making a visit for contraception or, something like that at 12 weeks. And just it gives you another time for somebody to lay eyes on you and make sure that you're doing okay, and address any other needs that you might have. Because, for example, IUDs aren't usually placed until at least 6 weeks postpartum if that's something you're looking at. And that's another visit where you get just another opportunity to get care.
And that's why I'm so invested in this, is because women typically don't see their OBGYN after 6 weeks, but they are seeing their pediatrician. And I feel pediatricians can really play a critical role in screening for postpartum depression and then, referring and getting mother's care. So I'm working very hard to raise awareness about postpartum depression screening in the pediatric arena.
Okay. I think we'll switch gears. There are a number of questions that have to do with medication. So we only briefly talked about that in the presentation, but in fact people have questions about what medications are safer in pregnancy, how does medication affect the ability to breastfeed? So a number of questions in that arena. If you all would like to speak to that.
So I think that Kate had one great slide, and that was this kind of balancing. It's a cost benefit calculation. The ideal scenario is mom is well and she doesn't need any medicines, right? And she can eat just healthy food and is not stressed, and that's wonderful. However, if the alternative is a mom who is untreated and has no access to, and so it's untreated and she would have the sequelae to her own pregnancy and birthing or the child's outcome of untreated depression, then really the other side is, so what are now safe options? And I have to say proudly, we at the, again here at the University of Michigan Depression Center, we are really working with, as number one, treatment options to provide behavioral options. Because from the data, we know that behavioral options, psychotherapies, supportive, evidence-based psychotherapies, are safe, have few or none adverse effects, and are effective. However, again, for mild to moderate depression, that might be effective. But there are cases where this alone is not enough, and medication treatments are necessary to support other treatment options like psychotherapies or alternative approaches. And the good news is that we have a range of medicines that now has been, that have been prescribed over decades to, I would say, thousands, hundred thousands of women, and where we have a collection of data speaking to their safety record. As everything in medicine, we never have the 100% assurance, right? There is no such thing in medicine that we can say, you know, if you take this medicine or if you do this, it's 100% assured that this might not have an adverse effect for you. If I would say none of the medicines we give has that record. The focus is for the most medicines not. The light is not shining on those medicines. It's the psychopharmaca medicines where much more attention is around what's their safety record. But in fact, we know more about the safety of antidepressants in pregnancy than about many other medicines in pregnancy, like antibiotics or other pain medicines. So on part, the scrutiny that psychopharmaca have about their safety record has actually the advantage that now we have really a collection of data on many, many women across continents, Europe, the Northern Americas. And so this collection of data is now pointing that certain medicines we know are absolute no, they have risks to the mother, and these risks go from teratogenicity, so that would be malformations. We know actually who are the culprits, which medicines not to take, not to give. One of those is valproic acid. That is a medicine that no childbearing woman, a woman who has a potential to have to get pregnant, should be on, because it's, if it's not necessary, if it's not really the only medicine that works for her epilepsy. We used valproic acid also for mood stabilization, but we have other options that are safer. So no woman should be on valproic acid. That is a teratogenic substance. But for instance, the antidepressants that we are usually giving, so-called SSRIs, serotonergic reuptake inhibitors, we have now hundred thousands of data that these medicines are not increasing likelihood of teratogenic outcomes. The problem with what we have, what we face, is that the studies that we have, there are many, many reports out there, and many reports out there on both in academic publications as well as on the internet. Partially these data are contradictory or confusing. And so patients and providers alike are sometimes left very frustrated and confused by what does this all mean now. So I think that what the best option is to really discuss this with a specialist, with providers who are trained in this area, who spend a lot of time reading up on the data and on all the registries of medication safety out there, and really have an informed discussion, and then weigh benefits and risk, and a little bit of uncertainty will always be left. That is unfortunately the case. So
I think the other thing to think about with medications is, and I see this all the time as an obstetrician, women come to me, and by their first prenatal visit, whether that's 6 weeks, 12 weeks, or 26 weeks, they've taken themselves off of their medications for various reasons. And they do that out of the best of intentions because they don't want to expose the fetus to any substances. But I think one thing that women have to remember is that, especially if your depression was not in a period of prolonged remission, your risk of becoming depressed again during the pregnancy is very high if you just stop your medications. It's somewhere up, or, you know, up to 70%. And then when you do have an episode again, what usually happens is not only are you re-exposed to medications because somebody is most likely going to want to start something on you, but it may be exposed at even higher doses because they need to get an effect now, because now instead of being mildly depressed, you're severely depressed and you're suicidal. And sometimes they end up having to use multiple agents on you because you are so sick. So I think it's one thing, again, the importance of having the discussion before any decision is made. And that's a mutual discussion between the provider and the patient, you know, and the mother. I think it's really critical because otherwise decisions can be made that won't work for the parents or may be detrimental to the baby and the parents in the long run.
I think, you know, as a researcher, one thing that I also like to point out, it's really complicated to tease all of these studies apart. And I think there is this sort of desire to go to the web and to read the first study, and if it's published in a high-tier journal, you know, big impact, to sort of conclude there is this risk, there is this association. But you have to think about some of the things that make it really complicated to study this well. And one of them is that we can't really do randomized controlled trials of assigning people to medication or to not medication to determine outcome. And so it's really, I think, hard to take one study and know what to conclude. And so I just want to underscore sort of that recommendation of talking to someone and weighing your options, someone who really makes it their job to stay on top of the literature and to know what the risks and benefits are and to weigh that together with you is really solid and good advice. And I think it's sort of, you know, the responsibility as professionals that we have to make sure that other professionals have access to state-of-the-art current science and to really pay attention. I know in our clinics, everyone, you know, when a new article comes out, if there's a risk identified, you know, everyone pays a lot of attention to that to try and understand how does this fit into what we know and how can this help us to provide better counseling to women. But I also think it's really important to appreciate that women often get a lot of negative messages about choosing to take medications in pregnancy, postpartum, or nursing. There's a lot of scare information and material out there. And I think as a collective whole, that's probably not warranted by the empirical literature. And it sure leaves people feeling bad. And I will add, you know, that providers need education. It's not uncommon that we will have people come to us because their provider wasn't comfortable with managing their medications in pregnancy. And so that's part of why, you know, I know the folks up here do the work they do with providers so that women don't end up in a situation where they have a provider who's not ready to provide that sort of guidance and counseling. So it's a big issue, and I think one that a lot of women have to navigate, unfortunately, without as much support as I wish they would have. I had, a couple of questions here that had to do with sort of preconception issues. So one was, if you know that you're at risk for postpartum depression, what can you do in pregnancy to prepare? Which isn't necessarily preconception, but the other one was a preconception question. Like, if you have a history of depression that's well controlled with an SSRI, you want to conceive, should you go off medication?
Great question, and I love it when people actually come in for preconception visits because a lot of times pregnancies are a surprise. But I think the first thing is, if you are a woman who's currently on medication and you're thinking about conceiving, again, come in, make an appointment with somebody who is informed in this area and talk to them about what your specific risk factors are, because they're different. Not every woman who is on medications pre-pregnancy has the same risk of, you know, the disease progressing or relapsing. And some of those factors might be how long, you know, what dose you're on. If you're just on a very tiny dose, that may be different than someone who's on a very high dose of multiple medications. If you've been in, you know, euthymia or you've been feeling good for a really long time versus somebody who just, you know, had a loss 6 months ago and they're still grappling with all of those stressors, those are very different risk factors for relapse. And all of those things will matter. How much support you have. So I always think of medications, you know, medications are a support for you. That's their intention. And if you're going to take them away, you may need to build up other supports to take their place. And if you're not in a position to do that, then maybe taking away the medication isn't a great idea for you. But either ways, I mean, this is a complex conversation, and it just needs to be had before any decisions are made kind of rashly. And then during the pregnancy, I think the same sort of things. You know, what are your specific needs? Why? What triggers your depression? You know, is it because you had a family member die? Well, in that case, you may benefit from having somebody to talk to versus, you know, are you depressed because you're an active drug user and you're kind of going up and down with drug withdrawal? So these are the different, I think, scenarios. And whatever scenario you're in, you're going to need different interventions to make yourself strong.
So this question is about the issue of infant temperament as a risk factor for postpartum depression and what can be done to help moms and babies where temperament might affect mood. I don't know if that's one you'd like to speak to a little bit.
I think the first thing to do in working with families with a child with difficult temperament is to acknowledge that that all children are different, and children have different temperaments. I think Kate talked a little bit about sort of media images of parenthood. There's a lot of societal preconceived notions that are out there about what parenting is going to be like. When people are parenting, usually they or friends are also having young children. There's a lot of talk with other parents, other family members. And there seems to be a lot of blame put on parents, especially parents who have children with difficult temperaments. So a parent who may be really struggling with a colicky child or a very fussy child or a child who doesn't sleep well will very commonly hear from family members, you just need to do this, you just need to do that. Well, I did this, this is what worked. Well, I just put my baby in the crib and they slept. Well, you just need to take naps. You just need to do this. And there's a lot of blame, I feel like, placed on parents, and then parents internalize that and think it's something they're doing wrong, which can add to their feeling of distress and guilt and depression. So I think, for me, the first thing to do is acknowledge that you are in a difficult situation. This isn't all, you know, your fault. You're responding to this child the best way that you can. And we need to come up with strategies to help support you in dealing with this given situation and trying to take the blame away from the parent and explaining to them that they need extra supports given the situation. And so that's, I think, a critical piece. Yep. And also letting them know that they're not alone. There are other parents out there in similar situations more than they think, and parents don't always come out and say say that they're going through similar things. And so some of the work we've tried to do is build some support groups around parents who may be struggling with children with difficult temperaments or going through depression, because it's often very difficult, and these families tend to isolate themselves even more because when they try to reach out to a friend of theirs, that friend may have a healthy child who's thriving and doing well, and they may be very happy, and that makes them feel even worse.
Right.
So they tend not to reach out. Mm-hmm. So trying to either put them in touch with some other families who are going through a difficult situation, trying to acknowledge and validate that their challenges are real for them, and strategize with them about how to get some more supports in place for them in the home.
I always have to say I work a lot with parents of young kids, and one of the things sort of to underscore what you were saying is that I always like to point out that it's really lucky if you had the great privilege of having children who made you good parents. but oftentimes that isn't how things play out, that, you know, kids are... they come with needs and, you know, differences in their personalities, differences in their temperament, and it can feel really hard to be a good parent in certain circumstances. So I think stepping away from the blame and recognizing that this is a challenge, but it's also one that isn't forever, and that, you know, parents get through, for example, colic. It's really, really hard. And they need that kind of support that Lisa's talking about, but also there's hope and it's not going to last forever. And that parents adapt and learn to get to know their child, and kids, you know, develop an ability to regulate, that there is some time limiting factor. So it's survival mode for a period of time is what I'll say to parents. And parents who have been there know that. They've been in that survival mode. So I think the blame, sort of taking that away and giving that perspective can be really important.
I just want to add, but also not to shy away to seek additional resources and supports for yourself as a parent during this survival time. I mean, survival mode kind of calls for, okay, I have a colicky baby and it's developmental. My baby is going to grow out of it, but it's going to take a couple months. How am I going to get through these months? And maybe that is by getting myself into a support group. We are offering a swaddling kind of support group. We are offering the Mindful Moms group, where we teach coping strategies or kind of have a discussion group, a peer support group, but also maybe seeking individual psychotherapy or even meds for a while to get through this time. So getting yourself also help to get through this. Sometimes it's like a half marathon or a 10K that you run, and you have to kind of prep yourself. So not shying away.
Well, and actually that leads perfectly into what I think was going to be the last question that we'll get to today, which had to do, it's when I started to ask earlier, but now we have a couple that have got to this. Are there special supports available if, you know, both parents are depressed, or also if you know that you're more likely to sort of have risk for depression, are the things you can sort of bring on board in the postpartum to help get that support? And you talked a little bit about the groups. Are there other things that you can think of concretely that parents might utilize or draw on to sort of help them at this time?
I mean, a lot of people derive support. So we have some support groups that we offer through the University of Michigan. But a lot of people derive support from the communities that they're in. I've had a lot of moms, for example, you know, if you're going to have twins, that is a very different pregnancy than a person who's not having multiples. And there are certainly multiple support groups in the community that moms have found tremendously helpful. Some people go to groups at their church, which has been helpful if you're a person of faith and that's important to you. I think online forums for some of my patients who are perhaps less able to socialize in public have been actually very helpful as well, just to have a safe space to share thoughts and compare struggles. And then, of course, there are the more professionally led groups that are available around the community and in all the different centers.
I would just add, too, if I may, that, you know, we talk, hopefully you're all aware of the notion of, you know, doulas, for example, but there are more and more postpartum doulas available to really provide that support. So there are resources in the community, and some of the flyers that we have out there will help you tap into that, and I encourage you to go to our website because we have lists of resources and materials that really will provide even more ideas and details. But first, or at this point, I think I just want to thank you for these excellent questions. They were great, and I want to thank our panelists for sharing their expertise and wisdom.